You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
The pressure builds. Three consecutive victories, unconvincing though they were, had calmed things down. And the tribute to the late, great Sir Bobby Charlton had reminded us why Manchester United is a special club and one that has enamoured the world for a century. But here, tributes put aside at kick-off, yet another humbling to our City rivals followed a decent first half stained by a baffling penalty decision. And when United concede, heads go. A fine start to the second half and the concentration gone, and the world's most lethal striker is allowed to head home unmarked. From there, United had little chance. Injuries, yes, and truly, how much does this game show us? Did you really expect Manchester United to beat City with only four of our regular starting 11? I certainly didn't. But any loss at United always acts as a magnifying glass to wider problems. The difficulty this time is those problems don't need a magnifying glass. They've been clear even when we've been winning. Welcome to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Harry Robinson. Jack Tate is with me as always. Today we'll discuss Ten Hag's team selection and tactics. We'll talk about the game itself, of course. We'll also talk about the wider problems affecting the club. You'll get your academy briefing as always, and we'll preview Wednesday's match against Newcastle. So let's dive in because there's plenty to talk about. And Jack, I'm going to start by playing devil's advocate a little. Did this really teach us anything new, despite it being very painful?
I think actually maybe the biggest thing that it taught us was that we're not very good on the counter-attack anymore.
Yeah.
Everything else, I think, was things that we sort of knew. And to be fair, I think you could look at certainly the first 20 minutes or so and say we had enough opportunity. I wouldn't say necessarily we had enough chances, but we had enough decent opportunities on the break that I think you'd look at a Man United team of 2 or 3 years ago and expect that we would have scored a couple out of those opportunities. Everything else was basically everything that we've expected. And to be honest, everything that we've experienced over the last half a decade of playing against Pep Guardiola's Man City anyway.
Yeah.
And obviously, given the injuries at the back, there is some amount of mitigation for at least maybe the goals, if not just the attitude and the effort levels in the second half. But I think, honestly, that was the main difference that I could see from this game compared to previous Manchester derbies, especially at Old Trafford, is that we just couldn't capitalise on the counter-attacks that we created.
Yeah, and the most glaring opportunity was the Højlund chance shortly after their goal, where he was pulled back a little by John Stones, probably should have gone down, and if he had, might have earned United a free kick, a penalty, maybe a red card, one of those three or two of those three. The first half was okay, wasn't it? Especially before the penalty, it felt like decent foundations were being built. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Second half, as the rain started to come down in buckets and the skies darkened at Old Trafford, it felt very much like a pathetic fallacy as things seemed to darken at the club and the clouds seemed to gather above Old Trafford once again. I think in times like these, it can feel as if there's so many ways to approach a conversation around this. So I want to go back to the beginning and the team selection, because the attitude amongst the United fans after the team was announced was certainly not one of confidence. Injuries, yes, but two of Ten Hag's kind of marquee signings in Antony and Mason Mount on the bench is interesting. And I saw, a valid point on Twitter that said, when things are nearing their end with managers, the managers throw their best goal getters out onto the pitch to try and salvage their tenure in moments. And I think that's kind of what we've seen in the last few games. McTominay scoring that remarkable double against Brentford, and suddenly he's out of nowhere become
one like a key name on the team sheet for United. It's baffling, even the fact that Ten Hag drops Antony for this game, which is a real rarity, to prioritise goal scorers. And as it happened in the end, as you say, we just completely lacked any kind of ruthless edge on the counter-attack. And looking at the team selection before the game, but also after, of course, now, I think the teams that are starting every week are decreasing everyone's faith in Ten Hag, because we're seeing him kind of change his ideas and sacrifice his ideals for players who aren't performing at the top level, and not put any faith in young players such as Hannibal, who have shown effort and quality.
I'm not so interested in the back four. I'm willing to give Ten Hag the benefit of the doubt on that. And even Reguilon playing over Lindelof, willing to just say, you know, Reguilon probably wasn't fit to play 90 minutes.
But Ten Hag said after that was a tactical point.
That makes it much harder to give him the benefit of the doubt. But yeah. I'm willing to sort of forego that, because even if you put Reguilon in there instead of Lindelof, that's still not a back four that gives you a whole lot of confidence. I guess that would mean you could play Lindelof at centre-back, but even with Maguire and Lindelof, you're probably still not feeling great about that back four. But the midfield just really was baffling to me. I think it's Mason Mount, I think, really, that to me kind of symbolises the confusion that is going on within the Ten Hag and his coaching staff at the moment. Because, you know, brought in for, what was it, £55 million in the summer, sort of marquee midfield signing. You know, and to be fair, at the time, I think we all sort of said, you know, Mount is a very good player. The issue will be, where does he fit in? And when you spend in that much on a player and you make him your number one target in the window, which he seemed to be, given how quickly United moved on that transfer, I think we all assumed that there was a clear plan in place for how we wanted to play with him. And maybe that plan was what we saw in the first couple of games, where you have Casemiro and Mount at the base of the midfield, and then Bruno Fernandes further up, and Ten Hag has completely abandoned it.
A second season in a row where he's made a midfield plan and abandoned it after two games.
Yeah. And even if we think that that was understandable, which, you know, we've said we can understand why Ten Hag has maybe abandoned some of those ideas, surely a game where your tactical plan is to pack the midfield, Mason Mount is perfect for that. This was the exact kind of game where you think Mason Mount is very good. He's very good off the ball, very good at keeping the structure of the team, and he's also good on the counter-attack, and he would have provided a bit more quality in those transitional moments that we were lacking.
Yeah.
And so why on earth is he not included in the team? And you mentioned Hannibal too. Hannibal's also shown that he's very good in those moments. McTominay, for all his goal-scoring prowess recently, he's not a counter-attack goal scorer. He's a goal scorer when you're playing against Brentford and they're 1-0 up nursing a lead, and you're going to be having 60, 70% possession.
You need a presence in the box.
Good positions.
Yeah. I understood.
Sense. And the subs at half time continued.
I actually think the subs made things worse, because I understood McTominay being kind of the big man up top with very good pressing, or at least very good work rate, and another kind of outlet alongside the very large Hoyland as well. Understood. Might not agree, but I understand. But then the sub to take Amrabat off, yes, on a booking, but to take Amrabat off and then move McTominay back into midfield, it goes against everything that we thought Ten Hag's team was going to stand for. It doesn't make sense. McTominay is, and it's not as if in defence, because I understand that Ten Hag's kind of sacrificed certain ideals in the way that United play out, because there's no Martinez, no Shaw, and in this case, no Varane as well. But midfield, we don't have injuries. Yeah, all right, Casemiro, yes. But this is a wider thing. This isn't just today. And to play McTominay, that it's not as if there weren't other options, and it felt like a huge fundamental error. It's hard to find an explanation for it, because United were okay at half in the
half time one is baffling too, because even Ten Hag, everything that he's done with McTominay since he came to the club has basically shown that he sees, as we all do, that McTominay is not a deep midfielder. If he's going to be playing in this team, he needs to be further up the pitch, not involved in build-up, and effectively kind of in there as a second goal-scoring option. And so you bring Amrabat off.
Which he was in the first McTominay, half.
But so then why on earth would you bring Amrabat off and put McTominay deeper. I understand why he wanted to bring Mason Mount on, but surely you take McTominay off to allow you to, or Eriksen off to allow yourself to do that. Not Amrabat, the only true holding midfielder in the team. Yes, he was on a yellow card, but so what? It was half time.
It plays into this wider feeling that, and we've spoken about this a bit, but Ten Hag obviously discarded what he set out to do after two games last season. And it was necessary pragmatism, because you can give examples of other clubs, like even other big clubs like Guardiola at City and Arteta at Arsenal, who had difficulties in their opening months, but they stuck with it. The difference is it's so much harder to do that at the current United, because it's just a bigger club. There's more attention. And you saw the kind of intensity of the media focus after those two defeats made it impossible to do anything but become pragmatic and win games. This season, injuries has forced that pragmatism again. And as we've both said, I think we both understand that. But it's dangerous now, because it makes his job so entirely result dependent. It makes it harder to stick with him through the hard times. Because instead of that ruthless Ten Hag we saw last season, who dropped underperforming players, we're seeing those players keep their spots. He clearly doesn't think they're suitable replacements for him. But Ten Hag, it's got to the stage now where Ten Hag is adjusting to players he doesn't rate, rather than the other way around. And you've got, as we say, young players who've come in, performed well, then they've been put back on the bench in favour of others. He's giving chances to players he clearly doesn't trust for no apparent reason. And that combines with the lack of identity there's no width, but we're also not narrow and compact. It's just the team is just there. 10 outfield players just kind of just playing and seeing what can happen. There obviously are some different patterns and tactics game by game, but there isn't any identity. And things we saw last season and even early this season with like the two centre-backs splitting, the centre midfielder going deep, something we spoke about being present in the under-21s and under-18s too, is clearly a kind of ideal of Ten Hag's playing. It's just not happening now. And that combination of him trusting players that we know he doesn't rate, rather than putting some faith in the youth or just dropping the pragmatism and implementing his philosophy, is making a rod for his own back. He's in very dangerous territory here.
I mean, I'll go all the way back to pre-season. I remember you and I talking, it might have been in our actual season preview episode, or it might have been the one just before, right after we played RC Lens at Old Trafford in pre-season. And that wasn't our best performance that day. But I remember being really, really impressed by the rotation that we had in build-up between, it was Casemiro, I think Varane was one of the centre-backs. I'm not sure who the other one was. It might have been Martinez, I'm not 100% sure. And I remember coming on here and saying how impressed I was with the movement that we had between those three. Casemiro would often drop deep, and when he did that, it allowed one of the centre-backs even to come and push up a little bit forward, take up Casemiro's position to give a better option, create more angles for the player at the back. Obviously, with Onana in net, made that much easier as well. And albeit pre-season, but there were signs that United were moving in a direction where we're creating some of that identity. We haven't seen that at all during the actual season, and certainly not since the first couple of games. And I understand that there are injuries that have made things more difficult, but as you just said, Ten Hag is making a rod for his own back here, because the point you made earlier about, you know, the team selections seem to give us less and less confidence every week. The team selections in themselves are evidence of just how far Ten Hag has strayed from what he on paper should want to do. And it's also evidence, I think, of how increasingly sort of desperate this is becoming.
Yeah.
I tend to think actually that, you know, football fans, and to be honest, especially United fans, considering how big a club we are actually pretty patient if they feel like they are presented with something that they can become invested in. And I think that's the thing. Yeah. So I think we could actually accept these defeats if we could see the foundation of something brewing, if we could see the plan.
And last season we saw that in the mentality and the ruthlessness. And we said at the time, this is great, we're loving it. This is kind of the first step. And next season we need to see some more regular patterns of play and more of a Ten Hag identity on this team. What's also concerning is that mentality seems to have disappeared as well, which is no surprise. Football's such a confidence game.
And the thing is for Ten Hag as well, last year, there were much, much more things that you could point to as being reasons why he wasn't able to play the way that he wanted to. Not only coming and needing to sort of settle things down, but also the fact that so few of the team were, you know, his players. He doesn't have that anymore. Even despite all of the injuries that we had yesterday, if you look at the team, Onana, Eriksen, Amrabat, and Hoyland, four of that 11 are all his signings. You add to that
plus Mount and Anthony on the bench.
Exactly. And you add to that as well, Reguilon too. And you know, even though these...
In fairness, I'm not sure Reguilon counts.
That's fair. But you add to that too, Bruno Fernandes, who isn't his player, but someone he's clearly sort of taken in as his player by elevating him to be the captain of the team. There are less and less, even with all the injuries. This is at least half of all the players available at Ten Hag's disposal are his players.
Yeah. He needs this is my opinion, but he needs to bite the bullet now and drop the pragmatism, implement his philosophy. He's being risk averse and just seeing things through, seeing a period through with injuries just doesn't work at this level in football, elite football in 2023. And it feels like he needs to almost take a step back and see the big picture and think, he's got so, as you say, it's the starting lineups are such like evidence, clear evidence of how far he's strayed. It's like he needs to take a step back and obviously it's a statement of the obvious, but it's a real test of his management. And will he be overwhelmed by the pressure, the magnitude of what's before him, that feeling of things sliding away, or will he come out the other side and be stronger for it? And United obviously will hope for the latter, as will we. And United need to give everything they can to help him. But as we know, that's not really how this club works. And I think with that, we should probably move on to the wider issues before coming back to some specific players and one refereeing decision in particular. A lot of analysis, as I say, defeats at United are used as a magnifying glass for wider problems that are just not spoken about as much when we win. It's the nature of things. But Guardiola's quote was much touted after, particularly by Gary Neville. He said, "The secret of City's success is that we are in the same direction. Me, the CEO, the sporting director, the chairman. That is why I think the club is so stable." And Gary Neville was using it as a contrast to United. And we all know, I don't think we need to spell out the obvious differences. It's such a hard balance at the moment. And I remember, I think we probably had a very similar conversation under when Ole's reign was slipping towards the end of, this is clearly not just the manager's fault, but what else do you do except change the manager? And I think that's changed this time. And in my opinion, United need to go through the pain with Ten Hag. He needs to, as we've said, he needs to show reasons for United to stick with him, which he isn't doing right now. And he has to show that, otherwise he's not the right man for the job. But it's valid to come back to the ownership and the structure, because you look at the team and yes, Ten Hag signings, but like Reguilon, Amrabat and Eriksen as our midfield signings, they're good players, but they're not the players you want to kind of be the center of a manager's kind of new era at one of the biggest clubs in the world, are they? And that's just one of many, many examples.
I mean, you can't look at what's happened at Man United at any point really over the last decade and not look at what's happening in the boardroom, with the ownership, you know, with the whole structure of the footballing side of the club. And of course, that still lingers. You know, that has to be taken into account. And obviously, the situation at the moment is potentially for the long term better than it has been in a long term, with the, you know, potential, albeit somewhat tenuous, of the Glazer family not having footballing control over the club, but also in the present very difficult because there is to some degree probably a bit of a power vacuum, and obviously it's just another headache for Ten Hag to deal with. That being said, this is still really bad, and it's a tough balance to strike, because I think what frustrates me, and I think probably actually frustrates other fans of other teams in particular, when Gary Neville often talks about United, is that as a fan, I completely understand where Gary Neville comes from when he says basically that all the focus should just be on the ownership because they are ultimately the ones that need to be held accountable for the mess that we're in. And while that is true, there is also an element of the present in this too. And at some point, players and managers also have to be held accountable because as we saw, 6 months ago, this is a team and a group of players and a manager that can and should be performing at a much higher level than they are at the moment. And that is a hard balance to strike. I think we had a Patreon question about this, but I tweeted the video of Carragher and Neville having their argument effectively on Sky Sports after the game yesterday. And I think they're both right. And I just think that two things can be true at the same time, that the ownership has been dragging this club down for 15 years, or more than that, almost 20 years now. But also that Ten Hag needs to be doing better than he is right now. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say.
But the point is, it's just the same again. It's a cycle. And we've had this with every manager. And so I think that's why, I mean, we've just had a similar discussion to the point that Jamie Carragher was making. I think I saw a bit of it. I didn't see the whole segment. You can have that discussion, but ultimately the point Neville was making, it was Matt Peck, one of our patrons, who asked this about what we thought about the Neville Carragher discussion. Why is Ten Hag not having success, given what we saw from his first season, given we know how talented a coach and manager he is? And it's the same reasons that Mourinho, Solskjaer, Van Gaal, and less so Moyes, but Mourinho, Solskjaer, Van Gaal did so poorly. Because he's been backed financially, but not with the structure. And that is exactly the same as every manager at United. And there's so much nuance to that and so much detail and further context to that, but that is the overarching point. And we've discussed that nuance and detail before, so we don't need to go into it again. But so the point, I agree more with Neville than with Carragher, but I agree with you that they are obviously both right, yeah, and both points can be true. But I think pundits keep focusing on the manager and the players every time. And it's every time it's, this player's not fit to be United captain. It's like, well, do you not see a trend?
It's hard to escape the sort of the lingering like shadow that the ownership and the lack of structure on the footballing side of the club has cast over everything that currently happens. And you are right that we're just repeating a cycle. And I guess really the only difference between Ten Hag and the last couple is that it seems like the falling down is happening slightly sooner this time. You know, the last couple in Mourinho and Solskjaer have had a couple of seasons of it being relatively okay. And then it's been the third year that it's fell down. And with Ten Hag, unless there is a big turnaround, it seems like that's happening in the second season.
And in fairness, I think so much of that, like this season has been fine margins. And we spoke about last season being fine margins. Most of them went United's way. This season has been absolutely the opposite. There's been so many moments where you thought, is this where United kick on? And then there's been another scandal, another injury. And maybe those are wider problems. Maybe there's something wrong with United Sports Science Department. I don't know. Maybe there's something wrong with the way that United are managed with regard to scandals. We know there were bad things that happened. There were wrong decisions, but we don't know if that's a consistent problem or a one-off. You can make your own mind up on that. But this season is... I still have, as I've said, to carry on having faith in Ten Hag, I need him to show his own personality and to come out fighting. And I don't feel he's doing that at the moment, but it has been fine margins.
I think to some degree, we spoke to someone in our Patreon Q&A during the international break. We were asked about, would we rather get top four or win a trophy this season? And part of my response was that I'd rather get top four because I think that has a better chance of saving Ten Hag's job. Not necessarily because I want him to stay at all costs. You know, if we're finishing seventh or eighth, he probably deserves to go. But I just don't think that changing a manager will change very much about what's happening at Man United. And I think that is really where my mind goes to at the moment, because especially with the ownership situation, I think that's the last thing that we need. And so you're right. I hope that Ten Hag shows basically what made him a coach that would get hired by a club like Manchester United. You know, he is clearly a very, very good coach, and he's sort of falling fail at the moment of all of the traps that Man United seems to put out there for every talented coach or player that ever comes into contact with this club. And I hope that he's able to show a bit of courage and personality to effectively just say, you know what, we're going to do this my way and I'm going to deal with what the, you know, the results that come, but we're going to create an identity and a real bravery in this team. Because that would give us as fans something to hang our hats on. I want to watch a team where every week, no matter who is in that lineup, I want to know how we're going to be playing. I want to know what, on paper at least, is sort of the theory of how we're going to win this game. Because at the moment, it's
immense. And it's partly like a comms issue with Ten Hag, isn't it? Where he's not getting across his ideas as firmly as he was last season. There's no sense. He doesn't come out saying there's no kind of ruthless decisions like getting rid of Ronaldo or dropping Maguire, taking the captaincy off him, dropping Rashford at that Wolves game. We've seen it with Sancho, but that's it this season. I don't know. You feel less, obviously it's results dependent, but you feel less inspired by what he's saying because he comes out after the derby and says, yeah, we're on the up. It's very Moisey. And that's a dangerous comparison.
I mean, really the only thing that he's mentioned in terms of the style or anything that he really wants from this team is he's talked about the pressing and the fact that we have so many possession regains in the middle and high third of the pitch.
Yeah. You got to do something with it.
Well, exactly. And while true, to be honest, I still think our pressing structure under Ten Hag is an absolute mess. I mean, I lost count of the number of times when we went a little bit more aggressive in the second half yesterday. Lost count of the number of times Ederson was just easily able to basically take four or five players out of the game. You know, our press is still very disjointed. We're still not jumping the fullback on when our attack and midfield do press high up the pitch. You know, Ederson every time was just clipping long balls out to Walker or Foden out on the wing, and then Man City were moving forward from there. It's where their second goal came from. Bruno Fernandes loses the ball out on the right wing. It ends up falling to Ederson, and you know, there's a long ball out to, I think it's Foden. Lindelof tries to close him down, doesn't win it, and then Man City are away, and they've taken our entire front three and a couple of midfielders out of the game. You know, even the thing that you'd look at and say, this is maybe the stat that shows Man United are making some progress, I still don't think that part of the game is
doing it at a higher volume, but I wonder what the kind of efficiency of that is. I don't know if there is a stat for that. I'm sure some stats person could tell.
There is. Take a look at Mark R stats on Twitter after this podcast. Our friend John McKenzie has been talking a lot about this quote from Ten Hag. He's obviously an out of possession addict to some degree, and he's been talking a lot about the different ways that you can measure the effectiveness of a press. And Mark Arstats had John McKenzie quoted a good graph from him showing for a couple of different ways that you can measure how United's high press is going. And effectively, United are good, but not great at the moment.
Well, that's better than most departments where we're bad, not good. So some silver linings. You mentioned Fernandes. I know you wanted to talk a little bit about him because Keane came out after and said, not captain material. I'm always a bit hesitant. Anyway, let's not have that discussion. What did you want to talk about, Fernandes?
I think for me, just on him as a player, I mentioned in the build-up to the second goal that he gave the ball away, and it really, really frustrated me yesterday because actually, if you go back and watch from about a minute and a half before Man City's second goal, we actually played some really nice football. Man City were putting us under some pressure. We had the ball sort of pinging it around the base of midfield and the defence and Onana. We managed to move the ball quite well. And then I think it was Johnny Evans played a really nice ball out to Dalot, who then laid it back to Bruno Fernandes. And we managed to, you know, play through City to some degree. One of the few times we actually did, we got the ball on the right side of the pitch on the halfway line. And Bruno Fernandes has options. And instead of picking a relatively simple one, keeping the attack moving forward, he tries to play an outside of the foot pass down the line to a run that Dalot wasn't even really making. And it ends up, you know, being swept up by, I think, Gvardiol, and then that's where Ederson gets the ball. And that sequence that I just mentioned started with our press being a bit disjointed. And I think it just got me thinking about the wider picture with Bruno Fernandes and so many trade-offs that he brings. And this, I find it hard to criticise Bruno Fernandes too much, I'll be honest, because he has dragged this team through so many moments in the last 4 or 5 years. Well, no, not 4 years, three and a bit years that he's been here. And I think it is hard to say that he is part of the problem because he has been our saviour to stop us from even more embarrassing moments than we've had over the course of his time here. But I do just think Bruno Fernandes, because of his play style, a team that is built around him as the main creative source, he is the perfect player to drag you from second to second or third when you otherwise would finish sixth. But I'm not sure he's the player that you should be building around to drag you to being a true dominant title challenger.
Yeah, well, he might have to act in that role this season, given that's how this season is lining up. Yeah, it's interesting. I always feel like Fernandes looks worse, partly when it's often such a setup issue where he's being forced to play deeper, where he's less good. And it felt a bit like that again. But yeah, I agree with you.
And like any of our players, I think that there's always the wonder of, you know, what would happen if, you know, let's say you put Bruno Fernandes in Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, Pep Guardiola's Man City, he'd probably look very different. And I think that's always a hard thing about judging players that have been at Man United during this period, because there are the way they perform for Man United.
I mean, you know.
And then what is the counterfactual? Yeah. How would they have been at any other team? And that's a hard thing to
City,
know.
He wouldn't play for most of the first year. He'd be trained in Guardiola's way, and then he'd come into the team and he'd be less obviously outstanding, but he'd be a brilliant player for them because he's hardworking. He's intelligent. I know it doesn't always look like he's got football intelligence, but obviously he does. He's a brilliant player. It's more likely that the instructions he's receiving are less clear than they might be at Guardiola City, and the structure is less good. We know that to be true. So he would follow more of the Grealish path, where you get this player who's been outstanding, individually outstanding, goes to City and is less individually outstanding, but very important. We better move on. VAR. This was that decision is appalling, and it's there's a reason we've come to it at the end, because it's obviously not what United lost. But we were building a decent foundations in that game. I think City were starting to put some possession together that would have eventually worn us down before halftime anyway, but who knows? We might have, Onana made some great saves and Haaland missed an opportunity, so who knows? But yeah, it's not why we lost. I think we would have lost anyway. But that is a terrible decision.
To me, this decision, I'm actually less concerned with this one incident on its own. Because like you said, we were going to get battered in that game no matter what, quite frankly. So I'm not going to sit here and you know, cry foul or anything like that. I think actually what it does, though, is it's a really good indication of just everything that's wrong with VAR in its current form. That contact happens multiple times every single game in the Premier League, and it's not brought up, it's not checked, it's not even considered. And the issue for me with VAR is that the only reason that gets checked is because the appeals from City players are big enough. And that's not me criticising them, they haven't done anything wrong by doing that. But that can't be the way that a decision gets checked or not checked by VAR. It's just based on the loudness of the appeals.
They stopped the play. Yeah.
And again, it just crazy. The way that VAR is used, the second the referee goes over to the monitor, you know that's getting given as a penalty. When really, it should actually be, right, who is it, Paul Tierney, Paul, go over to the monitor, you need to take a look at this, make up a decision. And we should be hearing that conversation as it happens. I mean, you literally just go 30, 40 minutes later in this same game, Harry Maguire wrestled Haaland to the ground in actually a much, much worse way than what Hoyland did to Rodri in the build-up to the penalty. Why wasn't that given? You know, if we want to make what Hoyland did to Rodri the threshold for a penalty, fine. I don't like that, but I'd actually be okay with that if it was very clear any contact in the box that impedes someone from their run is going to be a penalty. Fine. Let's make that the threshold then. Let's not just pick and choose when we're going to point out certain incidents over others and allow players to influence what we're doing. The Maguire-Haaland thing, I don't know actually if you saw it, Harry, in the stadium. I only noticed it because they showed it on a replay on the NBC where I was watching it here in the States. The ball was out on the left wing for Man City. I think Bernardo Silva was getting ready to put a cross in. Haaland held up the ball on the edge of the box and he tried to spin and run into the box. Maguire first blocks him off And then as Haaland tries to sort of move away from him, Maguire's all over him, wrestling him to the ground. Much, much more sort of vociferously than what Hoyland did to Rodri.
Very Maguire.
Doesn't get checked at all.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had, and since that Wolves game, it's like we've paid the price for that very fortunate. I mean, I still don't think it was that bad, the Onana one. And it happened a couple of times since, very similar things, and very little outrage over it. But we've paid the price for that, haven't we? Some terrible decisions, as well as some tight ones, which are just bad luck, like the Garnacho Arsenal. It's not a bad decision, it's just bad luck. But there was a Hoyland penalty shout in that game. At the time, I didn't think it was much, but having seen the replay since, you think, yeah, that probably is a penalty. Certainly more contact than Hoyland on Rodri there. And then, yeah, Hoyland running through against past John Stones. Stones clips him. He goes down there. It's undoubtedly a free kick or a penalty or a red card.
And this is the thing, VAR are punishing.
He then does a weak shot.
VAR are punishing outcomes, not the actual action.
Yeah.
Which is completely the wrong way to do it. Especially when I understand actually that refereeing normally is always going to somewhat be influenced by outcomes. Because if a player doesn't go down, you're less likely to see contact. That's absolutely fine when you only get one shot at looking
at it. But on video replay, it's
exactly. That can't still be the standard when you can look at it from every angle in super slow motion for 10 minutes after the incident happens. That cannot still be the way that it gets refereed. And I think the thing for me is that VAR was supposed to come in and allow us to clear up a lot of the inconsistencies. It's just made them worse.
Yeah.
Because we haven't helped clear up any of these subjective decisions. We're just kind of lurching from one to the other every single week. And that's what I'm saying. Actually, in some ways...
From a fan's perspective, we had no idea what that was for in the ground because we hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
The only communication in the ground is VAR checking penalty, decision penalty. Literally no one has any idea. People thought it was for handball. It obviously wasn't. It was only at half time where people got their phones out and had a look at BBC Sport or went on Twitter and saw the clips that they saw what happened. That's just, you can't have the fans in the ground not knowing what's going on. It's a shambles.
Look, I was so pro VAR when it first was introduced because I thought it would just really help clear up so many of the inconsistencies. To be honest, I thought it would help reduce a lot of the scrutiny on referees because I've always felt that referees have a much harder job than most people give them credit for. And actually, on the whole, they don't do it that badly. That opinion has been completely changed over especially the last year and a half, because I think we're seeing willful inconsistency from referees. These aren't mistakes. You know, Howard Webb is coming out on Monday Night Football every month and going through all the communication and everything. It's the same shit every time. And that's, I think, where it's so frustrating. To me, there's two options, I think, that we have from where we are at the moment. Well, there's probably three. One of them is keeping it the same, which I don't think should be an option, but probably is. The other two, to me, are you either just remove the technology in general, you just admit that it hasn't worked, we tried it, we can't figure out how to work it properly, we're just going to go back to what it was before. And at least that way, we could all maybe accept wrong decisions a little bit more and bring some enjoyment back into the game. And second, if you want to keep VAR, I think you've got to properly lean into the tech. Put a chip in the ball so you can properly know when it's kicked for offside decisions, for example. Get the automatic offsides and like they have in the Champions League and we had in all UEFA competitions. Put a chip in the ball as well so you can know when the ball goes out of play. Like the goal that we had disallowed against Brighton, whether that was the right decision or not, the fact that we're having to look at that from a camera angle that's not in line, where we don't have a good idea and you're just sort of guessing, it's a farce. So if we're going to use the technology, let's lean into it properly.
Yeah.
And actually try and make as many of these decisions objective as we can. And as part of that, what I was just going to say before was, this is what I'm saying about the Hoyland on Rodri one. I wouldn't like it in terms of the spirit of what I think football is. Football is a contact sport, and I don't think that should be a penalty. But I would be okay if in the name of consistency, it was made very, very clear that any contact that impedes someone in the box is going to be given as a penalty. I'd actually be okay with that, because at least we know, and players can adapt to it or choose not to adapt to it, just like they've adapted to the time-wasting stuff. Referees have got a little bit less strict on it.
The consistency of that has completely disappeared.
It has, but it has improved,
I
would say.
That was a three-week thing.
Referees have got less strict on it, but I think the start of the season has made players waste time a little bit less.
I'm not sure.
Players do respond, but you know we aren't doing it.
Yeah.
Or look at handball, for example. I mean, the handball rules are an absolute mess as well, but Look how many more players now do try and block things with their arms behind their back because they're worried about it. Players do respond when you change.
Oh, I agree with that. I just think on the time wasting, they've just stopped under pressure. They have just given up.
Yeah.
The game hasn't changed that much. And now they just give 3 or 4 minutes again. Anyway, we really should move on. But my final point on this, less on VAR, more on United's mentality, is since that Wolves, after the Tottenham game with the Garnacho handball, I was so pleased to see Fernandes come out. And some people see it's moaning and whining. I thought it's just what you do if you want to win anything. Fernandes came out and said, where's our apology for that? It's an obvious mistake. And it was. This is another just a complete unique one-off decision that's suddenly been introduced into one of the biggest games in world football. And Ten Hag comes out after and just says nothing about it. None of the players say anything about any... You can impact the referees, and that's what Sir Alex Ferguson did. And it's not the only reason he won, but it really fucking helped. And so many decisions go against us since that Wolves won, and we haven't said anything about it. And you compare that to how Liverpool have benefited from a variety of different decisions for some weeks now since Jurgen Klopp spoke about it. You look at Ten Hag speaking before the League Cup final about Newcastle's time wasting, that helped. It's just, yeah, they need to say more. And United's players surrounded the ref after the game. It's like, what's the point at that point? Do it during the game. You need to make an influence. Anyway, 40 minutes odd in, we should move on. We're going to go into a Patreon Q&A, and on the other side of that, and a short ad break for normal subscribers, we'll have our youth and loan roundup and then a quick preview of the Newcastle game.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, coming out of the Patreon Q&A and the ad break, we'll have the Academy briefing in just a second. But first, before Jack has to head off for the day, a very quick Newcastle preview. I'm just glad this game isn't at St. James's Park, Jack.
Yeah, it's about the only...
Otherwise, we could be battered.
The only thing you can say makes this a little bit easier. I'm also, in some ways, quite glad it's not in the Premier League as well. Although, I guess you could say it makes the stakes a little bit higher because it's even worse if we lose. I think biggest thing for me is the team that United put out in this game. Ten Hag has generally gone strong in the cup competitions. Going strong, in quotes, at the moment doesn't actually feel like it's going to be a very strong team. So you wonder if this might be a moment for Ten Hag to really ring the changes and sort of send a message to a lot of those more established players.
Yeah, let's have some youth, some fight, a bit of courage and see what happens and play properly, not just...
Hopefully Kobbie Mainoo will get some minutes as well. That would be great.
Yeah, I think he could come off the bench, although the under-21s have an EFL Trophy match the day before. So he might play in that. Perhaps not. Let's see. Anyway, Jack, I'm going to let you go. If people want to see your reaction throughout the week, they can find you on Twitter at...
At UTD Tate, T-A-I-T.
Lovely. Right. Have a good week and I will carry on. Speak to you soon.
Cheers, mate.
And it's worth talking about that EFL trophy game. But let's start with the Youth League. United lost 1-0 to Copenhagen this Tuesday. It's Salford City away, and they need to win to progress in the EFL trophy group stages. Really could be a tough game. They lost 8-1 at Bolton and drew 1-1 at Stockport before winning on penalties. So they've got 2 points so far in total. The Copenhagen defeat, United defended really well, some good tactics that surprised Copenhagen, their coach said, but they just couldn't do enough in possession really, and Copenhagen got a late winner. Kobbie Mainoo, who came back in that game, played 45 minutes. The under-19s now need some big wins away in Denmark and Turkey to be confident of progressing, really, a bit like the first team. The under-18s won 6-0 at Leeds United at the weekend. Goals came from Jace Fitzgerald, Malachi Sharp scored a double, and the others from Jack Fletcher, Ethan Wheatley and Harry Amass. And Ethan Williams is late low drive into the bottom corner grabbed our under-21s a point at Fulham in the Premier League 2 on Friday evening. Later this week on Saturday, the under-21s host Everton in a midday kickoff in Premier League 2. And in loan news, Alvaro Fernandez hasn't played yet this weekend because Granada play tonight. Centre-back Will Fish played 90 minutes for Hibs against Celtic in a 0-0 draw. That Hibs are 8th in the SPL. And Charlie McNeil was an unused sub again for Stevenage. He's not getting much game time there. That's all we have time for, because I am off to the book launch kind of party for The Men Who Made Manchester United. Thank you to everyone who's bought it so far. Especially thank you to those who have sent pictures of it arriving at your doorsteps and sent some really nice things or left reviews on Amazon. If you have read it, a review on Amazon will be massively helpful. So I would appreciate you doing that. And yeah, I might see some of you at the book launch after I told you about it last week. Hope so. And yeah, we'll be back after the Newcastle game, I think. Let's hope for something better. Thank you very much for listening. For more from me throughout the week, you can find me at HarryRobinson64. And patrons, thank you very much to you for allowing us to do this show and supporting us and letting us do those bonus Q&As as well, and those mailbag episodes. International break, your support is much appreciated. That's all for now. Have a great week. Try to forget about Sunday's result. Goodbye.
Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.